Not wasting a single second.
Neither am I.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. With me, my wife, Heidi Morales Ryan.
Almost didn't make it, huh?
Just got to that microphone just in time.
You were about to chastise me on air.
Well, I'm glad that you were there so we can get started.
I'm a consummate professional.
With a very tight schedule.
Exactly.
As well. All right, then. Well, last week we started a whole new topic with the How Music Changed series, Heidi. As I'm sure you remember, we are now discussing the pre-big band era, or essentially bands that were getting famous that eventually gave birth to the big bands era. Now, the thing about the big band era in general, I mean, you'd say the war years.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe like the mid-30s until the end of the war. This was a very interesting time in American culture because it was during those years that jazz was by far the most popular form of music in America.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was that jazz was pop music for that while. Now this show is dedicated to the music that allowed that to happen for the big band era. This is music that is not remembered quite as well, because it was considered old-fashioned by the time the big band era hit. And it was also, as I mentioned last week, sort of a forgotten for the other reason, in that it compromised from the music that was responsible for the birth of jazz, which is to say the New Orleans bands.
Mm-hmm.
So it's crucial in terms of development, potentially be forgotten, because it's in that in-between state. It's neither one nor the other. But there's a lot of good stuff from this era that needs to be remembered. And that's exactly why we're going to just play a few good songs from the years prior to 1935, picking up in the late 20s. And we're just going to bounce around. I'm not worried too much about a specific timeline, because what we're really talking about here are the artists themselves who were helping to make this transition happen.
Okay.
And the way that they were doing it. An artist that we had not picked up on yet at all that is worth mentioning is a band called McKinney's Cotton Pickers. They were actually made up. William McKinney was the drummer, and he basically decided to retire in order to manage his own big band. And what was kind of lucky for him is that around the time that he was doing this and putting it together, he got word that Don Redman, the really famous arranger with Fletcher Henderson, was a little bit unhappy with his predicament.
Hmm.
And McKinney was able to woo him away.
Nice.
So now all of a sudden, McKinney's Cotton Pickers has one of the hottest arrangers in jazz music working for him. And it was with, you know, Redman's assistance as an arranger, McKinney's Cotton Pickers were actually for a while just as popular as Fletcher Henderson, and they were able to compete on their own turf with bands like Fletcher Henderson and even Duke Ellington. So back in the day, this was a very hot band, and you might hear why on a track here performed by McKinney's Cotton Pickers called Four or Five Times. Oops, my bad. You know what I just did? I'm using the same disc that I used last week,
mm-hmm.
which means I've got to start at a deeper point.
Yeah, you already played that.
We already played that last week. I'm sorry. That, by the way, was Ted Lewis and his band with Sophie Tucker doing Some of These Days. If you want to hear that in its entirety, just find last week's show on the internet.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, here's McKinney's Cotton Pickers with Four or Five Times.
Various delight in doing things right. time, four or five times. We like to play, we like to sing, we like to go skedaddle-daddle-o, four or five times. Bebop one, bebop two, bebop three, skedaddle-daddle-dee, four or five times. Wow.
Yes, sure. Okay.
What?
Yes.
Four or five times, there is delight in doing things right. Four or five times.
Track was recorded by a great number of bands, usually with some sort of comedic effect.
Yeah, it does have a bit of a funny tone to it.
Definitely, but right there by McKinney's Cotton Pickers, one of the hotter versions of the song. And of course, you hear Louis Armstrong's influence all over
that
track.
Right, that scatting.
Yeah, completely.
Primarily.
It's really cool. Now, like I said, they were a pretty popular band in its time, so it would be worthwhile to play another track from them. And this is a band that was actually on the RCA label, which was very supportive of jazz. Around this time, some of the better jazz tracks actually stem from RCA Records in the late 20s. So that this is where the McKinney's Cotton Pickers were recording at the time, and they have this other track right now called Peggy.
Thank you.
Peggy. McKinney's Cotton Pickers. Great band. You can just
I'm going to dedicate that to your aunt.
Very nice. To my Aunt Peg. My late, great, wonderful Aunt Peg.
There you go.
Now, obviously, you know, with Don Redman doing his job there, these arrangements are fantastic.
Fantastic.
And you can just tell,
yeah,
you know, pretty much why this band will be so popular in its time. Problem was that he left the band around 1931. Oh, now, his replacement, though, was Benny Carter. Now, that's pretty darn great. You know, Benny Carter has a reputation to this day as one of the most most fine jazz musicians of all time. The problem was, though, you know, it was late at this point. The band had already run its course in terms of what it was doing. Times were changing. And most significantly, what was very unlucky for Benny Carter, is that the transition took place pretty much right in the midst of the Great Depression. And the band couldn't survive the change. With the Depression happening while the band was changing in terms of its personnel.
Did the Depression mean that there wasn't enough extra income for people to just go out and see bands?
That's a huge part of it. It's funny because I'm literally...
So financial support wasn't there, basically.
I'm reading my notes right here, Heidi, and it says, you know, basically about what was happening at this exact time. The public was not able to afford to go out and see live music performed or buy records. Work was hard to find for everyone, let alone musicians. Plus, record sales were at an all-time low, so there was a lot of bands that basically... This is pretty much why this series of shows, the Depression marks the changing of the guard, where because things more or less fell apart until they began to come back together again at the end of the Depression. So I think of most of this as pre-Depression music, or maybe sometimes during the course of the Depression as it began to set in.
Depression-era music.
Exactly. We also talked a little bit about the hot bands versus the society bands
right,
a little bit last week. And this next orchestra that I want to play is led by a man named Don Voorhees. Now, Don Voorhees goes all the way back to 1927, I believe, with his time on CBS Records, a label that was much more staid in its approach. When it recorded anything that it considered to be other than middle of the road, they would put it on what it considered to be its race label, OK. O-K-E-H. So Columbia was already segregating in terms of what they were doing from a society aspect. And Don Voorhees was very squirrely with the Columbia side of the thing. He represented the society part of it. And when they brought him aboard as a recording artist, they realized, of course, that radio was beginning to develop around this time. And they made Voorhees the head of their radio band, the CBS radio band, which made him quite popular and is why he had a great number of hits, because he was getting exposure on the radio.
He had a huge endorsement.
Right, exactly.
Him.
With CBS Records behind you, one of the biggest labels of the time, it was very easy to have hits. And this is one of his biggest hits, a sort of swinging version, from a society perspective anyway, of the song My Blue Heaven.
Happy in my blue heaven.
We have it, the Don Voorhees Orchestra playing a very society, you know, you could hear it. It's a very neatly arranged.
Rag.
It's clean jazz. What's happening there by the Don Voorhees Orchestra? That's the other thing that's happening around this time. Now, one artist that we will be covering separately on his own will be Django Reinhardt, especially his work with Stephan Grappelli, as they were like a guitar player and violin duo that were very responsible for the hot club stuff that was happening in France and in Europe, had a huge influence pretty much on the entire world with what was going on. But a lot of people don't seem to remember is that there was sort of an American equivalent of those two that were playing just around the same time, maybe even sooner. I'm talking about, you know, Joe Venuti and Eddie Lang. Joe Venuti was the violin player, and he was one of the first people to basically introduce violin to jazz, and Eddie Lang was one of his childhood friends. So they end up, you know, making recordings and becoming hugely famous for what they do. And it was around these same years, you know, the late 20s, early 30s, that they were getting popular. So Joe Venuti had his own band that only consisted of four people that was very popular around this time. Well, let's hear a track by them. This is a song called The Blue Room.
Holiday, because you're married to me. Not like a ballroom, a small room, a hall room, where I can smoke my pipe away with your head upon my knee. Bum bum butter, da dee 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 da 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 da. You'll sew my trousseau, and Robinson Crusoe is not so far from worldly cares as our blue room way upstairs. Thank you.
Those are two tracks recorded, credited to Jovanotti's Blue 4. Hmm. Now, Jovanotti, we were talking earlier about the OK label.
What do you mean by credited? You seem like you're inferring something there.
Well, because, like I said, he really was known for recording mostly with Eddie Lang. Oh,
okay.
And although Venuti would also record with people like Bing Crosby, the Dorseys, Benny Goodman, Jack Teagarden, everybody in jazz would try to get Joe Venuti onto their track mm-hmm. because he played such a great jazz violin. But he had his own group called mm-hmm. Joe Venuti's Blue Four, but occasionally he would put out recordings that were credited straight up to Joe Venuti and Eddie Lang. In fact, I got one of those right here, one of these tracks that are meant to show off their individual talents. The name of this song is Wildcat. Wow. Joe Venuti. You know, he's obviously a great player, but...
Not as good as you, but okay.
Oh, funny. But this goes really deep. If I was just going to play just the music, it would be kind of dry. I think to really... I need to color what this guy was about. I mean, we're hearing a guy who's basically sounds like he's full of life and everything else, but Joe Venuti, apparently, it wasn't just his violin playing that... he was like renowned for. He had a reputation. There were so many stories that are incredible. One went that he would never pay more than $25 for a violin because he was constantly breaking it over somebody's head.
Oh, okay. He was like pulling the Pete Townsend over somebody's head with a violin.
Yeah, imagine this. You know, in the 20s, this guy's smashing people,
awesome.
Smashing his instruments up on people. One of the most famous stories ever is that he was on the fifth story of a building, and there was mm-hmm. a grand piano there, and he got into an argument about what key the piano would resound in if they pushed it out a window. So Venuti pushed it out the window.
Oh.
I mean, just to find out what it would sound like when it hit the sidewalk.
Obviously, must have been a lot of alcohol involved.
You can imagine, right? Between stories like this and the things that Bix Beiderbecke went through, basically. But Venuti was able to survive it somehow with some crazy, either a combination of temper and a sense of humor.
Hmm.
Nuts. Total nut. Next character I want to cover, though, is a man by the name of Ben Selvin. Now, Ben Selvin eventually became known as the Dean of recorded music. He has actually recorded, this is according to the Guinness Book of World Records now, Guinness recorded more musical sides in its say 78 RPM records than any other human being. First of all, he recorded this because he was able to record for dozens of different labels all at the exact same time. He would change his name a little bit, change the spelling of his name, you know, just enough. He'd be Ben or he'd be Benny. He'd be Benny with an I, Benny with a Y. Just enough to basically,
just
you know,
keep you guessing.
Get away with it. It's been said that by doing that and by recording so many tracks for different labels, his output has been estimated at approximately 13 to 20,000 song titles that he had recorded.
Wow.
Amazing.
That's so stunning.
Not somebody who we can ignore. And here at the top peak of his popularity then is one of those tracks by Ben Sylvan and his orchestra. Let's hear their version of Happy Days Are Here Again. If you were alive around the time when Ben Sylvan was making all of these records, this is the type of stuff that you would probably be hearing if you were lucky enough to own a radio. Music like this. This is why he was as popular as he was and was able to record as many sides as he had, because this was the stuff that was getting airplay. The fact of the matter is that although shows like mine and pretty much any other jazz historian will focus mostly on black artists and the artistry that caused this music to develop in the first place, the fact is that the general public really was not hearing very much of that at all. It was very difficult for them to get to be, if even marginally aware, of the fact that there was this whole other thing. Society was still highly marginalized incredibly marginalized. So what you'd be hearing, of course, in these society orchestras or these radio bands or orchestras that were being put together were these very white, for lack of a better word, arrangements that were softening up and watering down the more influential tracks. And it's the influential stuff now, in retrospect, that we tend to play and look at. And it seems as if, God, the music was so great back then. Well, really, that stuff wasn't what was selling and wasn't what was popular to the average American. People were hearing pretty much what their cultures were demanding that they listen to. And they were still very segregated. That being said, this is why Ben Sullivan was the absolute best-selling artist of the first quarter century in the United States of America. In fact, this next song is the biggest-selling popular song before 1930, period. The number one best-selling record up until 1930. It eventually went on to sell 5 million copies. Because that sold 2 million pieces of sheet music. All by Ben Sullivan. Here's that song. It's called Dardanella. Isn't it hard to believe that a song could be that huge in its time?
It's funny. He got in that little whinnying sound at the end, but it was like so watered down. It exactly portrays what you're talking about.
Right. If you were going to say compare that to the hot jazz version say Livery Stable Blues and things like that. Exactly. It's fairly incredible. And yet here it is, this society version of what that jazz is supposed to represent.
Right.
And this is what sells 5 million copies and 2 million pieces of sheet music. That track by Ben Sullivan called Dardanella. Fairly incredible. Amazing, really. Now, at the same time, though, even though times are bad and society is still very stratified, obviously quite stratified, one thing that was kind of tending to unite people together was the Great Depression. The fact that there was just hardship all around began to make people, A, look for escape. You've heard that all the time about how pretty much when times are at their lowest, this is when people are looking.
Like when musical movies were coming out, you know, and songs like Pennies from Heaven, I guess, and stuff like that.
Well, how about that? The track we had just played by Ben Selvin before Dardanella was his version of Happy Days Are Here Again. That song is being played constantly on this new product called the radio while people's fortunes are evaporating,
yes,
before their eyes. You know, it certainly wasn't happy times, but the song provided, I guess, either a glimpse of hope or maybe it was just
gray
ironic.
Skies are gonna clear up.
Exactly.
Put on a happy face.
That's pretty much what it was. Now, in the meantime, you know, the New York Bank of the United States is collapsing. And jobs are vanishing left and right. Like I said, people's entire incomes, their entire life savings wiped away. And yet at the same time, radio is making inroads. It was the TV of its day, of course.
Obviously.
It's the first time that people have the opportunity to bring, you know, recorded music into their house. It's stunning.
The wireless.
And it's cheaper than a record player. So in some shapes and forms, some of these things are big and not that cheap. But in its simplest form, it was a beautiful thing. And now this music is getting disseminated a little bit more democratically, you could say. You know, people are hearing this all around the country, which is why in certain places like Kansas City, Missouri, all of a sudden it becomes a pocket of jazz. There's a scene that starts developing there because they're hearing these tracks. The bands are touring there. Radio is promoting it, and it ends up getting its own sound. Now, that sound, although most people credit it to Count Basie had a precedent. Somebody came before him, and his name was Benny Moten. Benny Moten had pretty much one of the most important blues-based orchestras in the Midwest in the 1920s. He had also recorded for OK Records. Columbia had gone out there and found him. And this is a guy that eventually would bring in Count Basie to play piano, and eventually Count Basie would take the band wholesale. But it was Benny Moten who was developing the band and ended up basically becoming nationally known with tracks like this song called Lafayette. Thank you. All right. Benny Moten's orchestra. Now, what's cool about this, that's literally quite hot.
Yeah.
Very hot. Very much influenced by the hot jazz that was coming out of New Orleans. But it has a few new influences now. First of all, I mean, obviously he's using the riffing that mm-hmm. was going on in the original jazz thing. But it's also this really hard stomping beat that would eventually be what would define the big band era and eventually go on to pretty much define what rock and roll would be about.
Mm-hmm.
It was really kind of going back to this point with Benny Moten. And also, if you remember just a few shows or a few series of shows back when we covered Boogie Woogie, how we talked about how the Boogie Woogie stuff was hugely influential on what would eventually become rock and roll. Well, there's definite influences of Boogie Woogie in what Benny Moten is doing here. It's all over that stuff. Now, he ended up, as I said, he was, you know, recording for OK, ended up with a huge hit around that time that ended up being re-released in 1935 and became hugely successful again, even though I think the song originally dated from 1928. So this was a hit in the pre-big band era that was so good that it went on to become a hit again in the heart of the big band era. So let's hear that track, because I always enjoyed this song. I never knew it was as old as it was, by Benny Moten and his orchestra. This song is simply called South. Benny Moten and his Kansas City Orchestra. Now, like I said, I just wanted to confirm my timeline here. And yes, this track was recorded in 1928, became an instant hit. In fact, it was so successful in general for the label. Actually, this came out on the Victor label. And it was so successful that it stayed in print for virtually the entire existence of vinyl. It stayed in print through the 30s, the 40s. When the vinyl 45 single came out, they released it as a 45 single.
That's incredible.
Didn't go out of print until RCA stopped making vinyl records.
Wow.
How about that?
That's saying something.
Pretty incredible. Now, the sad thing is, imagine this. He died in 1935 because of a botched tonsillectomy.
Oh, that's tragic.
Crazy. Now, the man who was in line to take over for him was the piano player, who was sitting there, had his own ideas of what was going to happen. And that man, of course, was Count Basie. So this next track is Count Basie with Benny Moten's Kansas City Orchestra doing their version of a song dedicated to Benny called Moton Swing. Now, Count Basie, by the way, I should mention, is going to be is one of the 250 topics that we have in our master list of topics that we will be covering in How Music Changed. This whole pre-Big Band era being one topic, Count Basie is going to get his own. So we're going to be covering him in depth at some point in the future.
So, in other words, you only just get a taste.
Right. Now, just getting a taste, because we're going to be getting into the whole history of the man sometime in the future, provided I live long enough to do all of this.
Well, we'll see.
At the rate we're going, I got to live to be about 172.
See if I'll let you.
Maybe I'll get lucky if you don't kill me first. See what goes down. Now, since we're talking about that as well, I should mention all of these shows we save for posterity in case you as a listener want to hear some of them again or maybe catch up on some of the history that we've already covered. Maybe this is new to you and you want to dig back a little bit. Well, we've already done about 250 shows for this whole series, How Music Changed, and we posted them all on our website. So you can hear every single one of them any way you want to, any time you want to.
That's right.
They are all available to be played on demand. All you got to do is, if you got a computer, just get onto your favorite search engine, whatever you use, and type in the name of our show. Type in American Hit Radio, and we are certain to come up right at the very top. And right there on our homepage, you'll see this show, the Friday show, at the top on the right-hand side. You'll see our Wednesday show at the top on the left-hand side. Whichever one you want to dig through, it's all the same thing. There's a button that says See All Shows. And you can just wade through them and see all 200, 300 shows that are available for each of these
Put
two
Put on your
things.
Hip boots.
So this show as well will be available. Last week's show, all of that. So hope you get a chance to check it out, and I'd love to have you join us on the internet at our website. All right, we only got time for maybe one or two more. So let's talk a little bit about somebody that we're going to cover a bit today, and we'll get into depth a little bit more about this guy next week. His name is Jimmy Lunsford out of Memphis, Tennessee. Pretty much just a guy who put together one of the first student bands in Memphis. Just high school band, basically. And they were good enough that he eventually be able to take the boys out on the road and tour pretty incredibly. He got so successful that by the mid-30s, he was actually playing at the Cotton Club.
Wow.
Competition for people like Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway. So Jimmy Lunsford, why? Well, it's because he was performing songs like this one called For Dancers Only. Might be asking a lot, but if you remember that riff next week when we come back and play a little bit more Jimmy Lunsford, you might recognize how that was a theme that he returned to over and over again. I say that because one of his big hits was "Tain't What You Do, It's the Way That You Do It."
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to leave you with one more from Jimmy Lunsford now, and I hope you can join us next week as we continue our look at early big bands, or bands from the real pre-big band era. We'll be back next Friday at 5 for more of this, so hope you can join us. Take care, everybody. Meanwhile, here's Jimmy Lunsford again with his orchestra with a song called Swingin' Uptown. Take care, everyone.
Goodbye.